From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, NPR senior editor and correspondent Ron Elving talks about the fast-developing national political scene.
Later, how art therapy focuses more on the process and less on how a piece of art turns out.
That's totally normal for you to want it to look good. But just so you know, I'm not judging your artistic ability, and it doesn't have to look good. It just has to do what it needs to do to get you to a place to be able to manage your emotions or whatever goal it is that we're working toward.
The last play of the Renaissance Theater Works season is set at the dawn of the Jazz Age in New York.
And a project coming to Milwaukee tonight brings to light some long-lost Yiddish songs.
We wanted to create a project that will allow these materials to be what they were supposed to be, to be music, as opposed to be a subject of academic research.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. The complex political times continue in Washington this week, with the shadow of a Democratic filibuster looming over Neil Gorsuch's nomination to the Supreme Court. There's also news of revived talks of repealing the Affordable Care Act and more reported disclosures of connections between Russian officials and members of the Trump transition team.
Ron Elving is following all of these stories closely in his role as senior editor and correspondent on the Washington desk for NPR. His long career in journalism started in Milwaukee, covering city, county, and state politics for the Milwaukee Journal. He was in town this week for a WUWM event and joined us in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
So let's talk about the here and now of the Trump presidency, or as here and now as we can talk ahead of the airing of this interview. As we're having this conversation, there are a lot of questions about the future of President Trump's pick for the open seat on the Supreme Court, and that's because Senate Democrats say they have enough votes to sustain a filibuster. What would Democrats hope to gain from filibustering this nomination?
They may not gain anything except the satisfaction of knowing they had done everything they could to stop a nominee they really believe may tilt the court in a direction away from their philosophy for the foreseeable future. 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, inconceivable he could serve on the court even longer than that. So we have seen people serve into their 80s. It's quite possible Neil Gorsuch will be part of a conservative majority for the foreseeable future.
And this wins them political points largely with their base, right?
Yes, and that's quite important to Democrats who are running for re-election in 2018 or 2020. They need to keep their hardcore on their side. They need to keep their funders writing checks. And also they need to persuade people not to run against them in primaries. And I can think of at least one senator who was very concerned about having one or two primary opponents in 2018. He didn't need that. He wanted to have a clear shot at re-election. So that, I think, would have to be a pretty big thumb on the scale.
Well, but this is also a very calculated risk, right? Because by employing a filibuster here, it could goad Senate Republican leadership into deploying what people are calling the nuclear option.
Yes, and we expect that to happen. Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, has made it very clear he's prepared to do this. It would be extending a decision that the Democrats themselves made several years ago when they decided to rule out the filibuster for presidential appointments below the Supreme Court level. And now that's been applied to cabinet choices by President Trump. It's been applied to a number of federal judges at lower levels, circuit court level, district court level. So now it's just being extended, logically enough, to the Supreme Court, which was exempted when the Democrats did it. That was a sort of a bipartisan sort of gesture of, well, we'll allow filibusters for a Supreme Court justice. But unfortunately for the Democrats, they did not get the opportunity to serve in the majority while the president was still in office to appoint his choice for this seat, Merrick Garland, when it was vacated by the death of Antonin Scalia.
Well, and so there are some who say the strategy for Democrats ought to be not to filibuster this nomination, but rather to employ the filibuster for the next one that potentially comes down the road. What would the advantage be in doing that?
The theory being that Neil Gorsuch is an outstanding choice within the conservative world, that he is eminently well qualified. No one disputes that. And that it would make more sense, since he's obviously replacing a conservative in Scalia, it would make more sense to save the ultimate weapon for that moment when perhaps Ruth Bader Ginsburg or one of the other senior Democrats on the – or Democratic appointees, I should say, on the Supreme Court might retire. And that moment may not be that far in the future. There are several who are in their 70s and 80s. And so that could happen at any time. And perhaps that would be a more crucial moment at which to employ this strategy. But of course, if they waited, Mitch McConnell could just exercise the nuclear option then.
Right. So that raises the question of whether the filibuster is even an ultimate weapon if the nuclear option is sitting out there in any case.
That is correct. But the philosophy, if you will, the mood, the atmosphere of the Senate has changed in recent years, not all at once, but progressively. And that change has made the Senate a much less cooperative place, a much less chummy, clubby place. And the sort of partisanship that we've always associated with the House has really infiltrated the Senate, along with a lot of people who had served in the House.
So at the same time, is there a political risk for the Republicans if they employ the nuclear option?
Perhaps. Some thought that a year ago when the Republicans refused to even consider or have a process for Merrick Garland, who was himself quite a moderate choice for Barack Obama, much more so than his other appointments to the Supreme Court, it was thought that the Republicans might pay a price for that, that they would seem overly partisan and harsh in just totally ignoring the man and not even giving him a hearing when, after all, President Obama was very much the president when he appointed him.
So the other story making headlines, or another story making headlines, there are really so many stories making headlines right now, but is the reemergence of the effort to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. The Trump administration was openly critical of the more conservative faction in the Republican Party for its opposition to the bill that was on the floor and then was pulled from the floor. What do you make of these apparently rekindled talks?
The president has threatened several members of the House Freedom Caucus, which is the most hardcore conservative group, by name in his Twitter account, saying that they would come after them, maybe have people run against them in the primaries. That's a potent threat. Also, obviously, this president is very popular within the Republican base, so it is high pressure on the House Freedom Caucus to have the president so exercised with them, and he is going to force them, I think, to make a really tough decision. And so that's why they're talking to him again. How well those talks are going, we don't know yet, but at least they have been forced back into a conversation.
And what sounds like the difference this time around is that there is an effort to scrap, or at least partly scrap, one of the most popular provisions of the ACA, the coverage of pre-existing conditions. How is that likely to work from a political standpoint?
It would seem that that would make the bill all the more unacceptable in the Senate, where it has been declared dead on arrival if it should ever arrive there, and it hasn't yet. But the Senate, even though it is Republican-controlled, is much more closely divided, and the loss of three Republicans on the bill would mean that it could not pass. Again, as long as we have the filibuster for legislation, they really need more than a simple majority in the Senate. So if they're going to pull over any Democrats and hold all their Republicans, they can't be messing with the most popular things in Obamacare. Maybe Obamacare isn't popular, but the idea that you can't be denied insurance for a pre-existing condition and that you can keep your kids on your policy until they're 26, those are quite popular.
So we've talked about the Supreme Court nomination. We've talked about the Affordable Care Act. How might these two issues and others down the road might be impacted by the ongoing Russia scandal?
The Russia scandal undermines the president's general authority and also the expectation that he's going to be the president for four full years. Now, I think you have to get out to the fringes of the Democratic Party or to some kinds of liberal media before you find people who seriously think that the president is in any danger of serving a full term. But because there is even that discussion so early in a presidency, that gives a certain amount of indication of how seriously people take these allegations of collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russians who were trying to interfere in our election.
Are there any indications that it's having any impact on their ability to gather Republican votes where they're needed?
If the president were at 60% approval, as most new presidents are well over 50% approval, if he were up there, the pressure that he is bringing to bear now on the House Freedom Caucus and on others would be all the greater and perhaps irresistible. But the fact that he is somewhat less than as popular one would expect a president to be at this point, that gives a little bit more leeway to an individual member of the House who may feel his own or her own popularity is much greater than the president's back in the home district and that they shouldn't feel in any sense endangered by his disapproval.
You got your start in this business here in Milwaukee in the wake of Watergate, and that was an essentially unprecedented time in Washington, save for maybe the Andrew Johnson administration, which neither of us remembers all that well.
Thank you.
And yet this current situation seems to set a whole new unprecedented standard. Can you talk about the challenges of providing context for such a breathtaking period in our political and social history?
Well, one challenge in it that I actually appreciate is the chance to talk about history. It was 40 years ago this month that I got my job offer from the Milwaukee Journal when it was a separate paper from the Sentinel. And yes, at that time, people had a certain attitude towards Washington, and it was a highly partisan attitude. And we have had in the four decades since a certain amount of back and forth in terms of more and less partisan eras. It sometimes depends less on the party of the president than on the personality of the president. But in this particular moment, things had reached a brackishly hostile partisan low point in Washington before Donald Trump came along. Donald Trump was aided in many respects by that negative atmosphere, and he has promised to cure it one way or another, drain the swamp and so on, and perhaps he will. But thus far, at least, the effect of his presidency has been to make it all a little bit worse.
Ron Elving, thanks for your work in the swamp.
Thank you, Mitch. Pleasure to be with you.
Ron Elving is senior editor and correspondent for the Washington Desk at NPR. He was in town this week to speak at WUWM's Morrow event.
How the art therapy work by two practitioners connects with an exhibit on display at Jewish Museum Milwaukee. That story is up next as Lake Effect continues in just a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. A few weeks ago, we shared the story of a remarkable exhibit at Jewish Museum, Milwaukee. The exhibit features a set of fabric collages created by Esther Nissenthal Krinitz, a woman who survived the Holocaust by fleeing her Polish village ahead of a Nazi invasion. Making the tapestry served both as a way to share her story with her daughters and as a way for her to work through the traumatic experiences of her childhood.
In essence, Krinitz had designed her own art therapy program. It has many similarities with how practitioners in the field help people. Later this month, the museum will host an event on the power of art therapy. We're joined by the museum's director, Patty Sherman Sisler, and two of the people on that panel, art therapist Emily Nolan and Jim Tassie, co-director of the Feast of Crispian, which pairs professional actors with post-deployment service veterans. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Mitch.
And Patty, I wanted to start with you. How do you see this work that you and your fellow panelists are talking about as connecting with what a museum, yours in particular, is all about?
The Jewish Museum Milwaukee's tagline is where conversations happen. And our current exhibit, which is The Fabric of Survival, The Art of Esther Nissenthal Krinitz, is the story of Esther, who lived in Poland pre-World War II, documenting her life pre, during, and post-World War II in fabric art. As we looked at the art and we talked about what Esther did as an artist, and we talked to her daughter, we really talked about how this was not only documenting her life, but it was cathartic for her. And it was a way for her to deal with her trauma, which led us to talk about what community resources are there out there for people in Milwaukee to deal with their traumatic experiences.
Well, and Emily Nolan, I wanted to ask you, because I had a chance to interview Esther's daughter about this exhibit, and I don't know whether you've seen the panels, but the thing that struck me was this seemed like it was art therapy that didn't necessarily start out consciously trying to be art therapy. And so I guess the question is, does there have to be a conscious decision for it to serve a therapeutic purpose?
I think that art making itself can be therapeutic. I think that there's some debate now as to whether or not there needs to be an art therapist present to make that more intentional, and I would tend to agree with that. But the basics of art making can certainly be therapeutic on their own.
And I wanted to ask both you and Jim about how the art and the mission sides of your personalities developed. How or when did the light bulb go off that connects these two parts of your brain, the part that is interested in making art and the part that is interested in helping people?
I made art from a very young age, and I enjoyed the way that it made me feel in my body. And when I was deciding what to do for a career, I wanted to be able to bring that to others, and I didn't quite know how to do that. It wasn't until I was actually an art teacher in a school outside of Chicago where there was a lot of gang violence that I had the opportunity to work with a group of young men who were stuck in a situation where they were fantastic artists. They used the art studio to hide because if they left the art studio, there was a chance that they would be recognized as a gang member, which they didn't want to be affiliated with. And so working with these boys helped me to understand that I needed more skills to be able to take that soothing aspect of art and be able to bring it really into the therapeutic realm.
You talked about how the doing art made you feel growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Did it surprise you that you realized you had this feeling in common with these young men that you know were at risk of being identified as part of a gang?
I think that it immediately resonated with me that if I felt it, of course other people could feel it too. It was just a matter of helping them or recognizing that they could tap into it.
Jim, talk about how these two parts of your own personality developed.
Sure. Here's what I think. I think it's possible for art to be a place where it's safe to be frightened. It's safe to be afraid. There's a way of doing that, of really being of exploring that. In our work with veterans, the Feast of Crispian, we looked at veterans in various phases of reintegration, addiction issues, and one of the points that became very clear in that constellation of events was a shutdown of emotions. So from an actor's viewpoint, that's something that you use. You are the instrument of your own observation and expression, and you use yourself. You use your own stuff. So for the veterans, we thought, our idea was, well, what if we play? What if we pretend and hide behind the mask of the character and still allow those emotions to come up? And that's what's happening for us. We're starting to find that. And then the last thing I would add in terms of art is that what we're finding is that when you shut down one emotion, you shut down a bunch of them, and that pretty soon nothing, you have no feeling about anything. Man delights not me, says Hamlet. But that when you get a chance to taste it, even as Brutus, as somebody else, it's still your stuff. But you get a chance to explore it fully and put it into the language and have something to hang on to.
You talk about your realizations that these two worlds connect. Do the people that you're working with have to come to the conscious realization that these worlds are connecting, or does the therapy just happen?
I just left working with a client, and we were working with intention, and we were trying to really create a solid intention for the client to be able to move into just what you were talking about, being able to, she can't feel joy if she doesn't feel pain, and feel those two things together. And so I think that there has to be an inkling of an awareness, but then we can work to bring that awareness into full intention.
Yeah, and I would respond, I don't think you need much. We tend to do our stuff and then talk about it later, have the experience. I believe as an artist that we learn by experience.
Yes.
as much as cognition. And so most of the time we say, jump in the water, figure out how not to drown, and we'll talk about it later. That's kind of the deal.
Let's embody it. Let's
exactly
try it
so.
Out.
Right, exactly
yeah, we
so.
Can sort it out later, but
right.
Bring it into your body yep. And let's see what happens.
I quite agree. Let's do it. We'll decide what to call it later.
Yeah.
Is there an opening for people to start that process just by seeing a static exhibit, if you will, in a place like a museum?
I definitely think so. We've experienced people returning again and again to this museum or to this exhibit. Some of the comments have been that it's been very profound, that they looked at the juxtaposition of the beautiful artwork with the horrendousness of the story and had a cathartic experience. We have also used and have programs associated with art making so that people can go down that road. And we also give them a place to write about their feelings in the exhibit, what they see, what they thought, and how it affected them.
Emily Nolan, I think people might have a general sense for how, you know, psychotherapy works, for example. But can you give us a peek into the world of how you work with a client? Because it's, I think, kind of a mystery to people who have not been through art therapy, how you go from someone walking in your door who might be dealing with this or that and using this tool that maybe they don't even know they have.
Sure. Well, there's lots of different ways to work with people. And we work with individuals. We work with groups and communities as well. But I can give you a snippet of working with an individual. And for me, I really like to connect with the client. I mean, all of this only works if there's a trusting relationship that is in place with the client before any of this happens. So I make sure that I'm building with rapport with the client, but then the client comes in and we do a check-in as to how their week was and what's most relevant to where they are right now. And then because I'm creative, I come up with what I call an art task or an experiential for them to work on right there in the session with me. And so I will give them a limited choice of what materials to use. Those materials are based on what sort of control properties they have, and then the client will make the choice and address the issue for whatever visual way they want to do it and we've decided would be best. And then we take a few moments at the end, you know, to really process what the experience was like for them, what they feel in their body, what thoughts and feelings they're having in relationship to the artwork that they made.
Let me ask a really basic question. Does proficiency come into play?
No, it doesn't, because really what happens is that it's all about the process, and it's process-oriented, which can be a bit of a trick because it's countercultural. We're mostly product-oriented in our culture. And of course, people come in and they are worried about how their artwork looks, and we say, you know, that's totally normal for you to want it to look good. But just so you know, I'm not judging your artistic ability, and it doesn't have to look good. It just has to do what it needs to do to get you to a place to be able to manage your emotions or whatever goal it is that we're working toward.
Jim, obviously things are a little bit different for you because people have to make the conscious decision to be there and be part of this specific output, if mm-hmm. you will. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, talk about the proficiency there and the leap people have to take to want to expose themselves in the way that what you do with them exposes themselves.
Yeah. As we mentioned earlier, I think we put them in a situation where they're doing the words very quickly. These are techniques that have been devised by a group from out in the East Coast called Shakespeare and Company. They're rehearsal techniques. So you simply stand beside the actors, the veterans, and you say the words in their ear and they say the words to their scene partner. So they're in the middle of this thing. And what happens is there's this really lovely, from my point of view, kind of character muting. I'm giving Brutus his lines, and before long, he doesn't know whether he's Brutus or himself, and he starts speaking from that point of identity. And what happens is all of a sudden, his own stuff starts coming up, and it's the wonderful, dense, metaphoric language of Shakespeare that pulls a lot of emotion out of people. And all of a sudden, things start coming up that they haven't been able to deal with. That in a more formalized of therapy, they can't put words to. That for which I can find words is already dead in my heart, Nietzsche said. And that's why I believe experience is so important.
To bring it all into the here and now.
It's there. It's in the present.
Right. Yep.
Yeah. The immediacy.
Right.
Yeah.
Is there a fundamental question about art you have to be able to work through in order to do this work? The question of who it's for? This art is, at its heart, not really about the audience.
Yeah, that was actually something that was difficult for me, being an artist as well. And before I became an art therapist, I went to art school and I became an art teacher and I was teaching techniques to people. And it was about the product and very product oriented. And the product scared me to death. And so for a really long time, I didn't put any marks on any pages because I was afraid of failure. And so the way that I worked through that is when I finally said, you know, I'm denying something if I stop creating because I'm afraid of the product. And so I slowly started to keep a visual journal which to me was the gateway because I was able to close the visual journal and I didn't have to share it with anybody else, but I was still expressing it. So I did have to work through that for myself and say, you know what, I don't care. This is something that I need for me, and so I'm going to do it regardless of what it looks like.
Does art still make you feel the way it did when you were growing up and becoming an artist?
100%. 100% of the time.
Drawing on your story about, and forgive me, I don't remember her name, the woman.
Esther.
Esther, and her attempt to capture her memory in fabric. I mean, it seems pretty clear that she was doing it both for herself and for her children. For the vets, the stories that they hold, the stories that they have, many of which are horrific, and for which they have served for our needs. So at one level, it's about the personal pop. Okay, this is happening to me. What I like to tell the vets is, what we like to tell them is that possibly as a veteran, you have one last duty, and that's to make sure that your story gets out to us. So to answer your question, yes, there is both a personal and a relationship with a larger population in terms of that resonance, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, Patty and Jim and Emily, thank you all for sharing these stories with us, and best of luck to all of you in all your work.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Mitch.
Emily Nolan is an art therapist and director of the Bloom Center for Art and Integrative Therapies. Jim Tassi is co-director of the Feast of Crispian. And Patty Sherman Sisler is director of Jewish Museum Milwaukee. There's a link to more information about the museum's exhibit and event series on art therapy at WUWM.com.
In 1919, New York City, life is about to change forever. We'll learn more about the Renaissance Theater Works production of The Violet Hour when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tuck.
And I'm Bonnie North. The end of the First World War in 1918, the Great War, heralded a marked shift in Western culture. Music, theater, visual art, and literature all changed, both in response to the war's carnage and as a way of deflecting its horror.
In the United States, the Jazz Age was about to begin. Women got the vote and their hair and hemlines shortened. By 1919, there were already more than 7 million cars registered. The country, especially New York City, was vibrating with optimism and hope. And it's at this particular historical moment that Richard Greenberg's play, The Violet Hour, is set.
The play's the final offering of the season for Renaissance Theater Works. Marty Goebel stars as the singer Jesse Brewster in the production, and Julie Swenson directs. They join me in the studio now, and Swenson says the company has been wanting to do The Violet Hour for years.
It has more people than we have done in the past. There is a pretty big set and a very interesting prop component that we weren't able to do financially for quite a while, and thrilled to finally be able to do it.
It takes place in 1919. And it's in a publisher's house, or sort of, in an office.
Right.
And there's this really interesting group of characters that kind of come and go. And as you said, there's this prop component that sort of arrives and somewhat creates chaos. Don't want to give too much away, because it's one of those plays where, you know, so much is revealed as it goes on that we sort of have to talk around it. Mm. But one of the characters, Marty, is Miss Brewster.
Yes, Jesse Brewster, who is loosely based on Josephine Baker. She's a famous jazz singer, and she makes some marvelous entrances, and her life is entangled with all of the other characters. It's been fantastic playing her. And I wanted to talk a bit just about 1919, which is a fantastic time to set a play. This was, you know, just after World War I, Manhattan was just crazy. And it was the one time where everything was really, really hopeful. And we have no idea, of course, that within 12 years, the stock market crash was going to happen. But what's important to me is that African Americans and Caucasian people were celebrating the end of this war together, and a lot of the racial issues of the day are kind of set aside for this gaiety that everybody is involved in. And of course, we're about to move into some good times in 1920s. The birth of jazz is happening, and the popularity of it. It's just a time of great invigoration that's happening, and optimism.
Right, yeah.
And Manhattan is, New York is literally the center of the world at this point in time. And you feel that energy through these varied personalities, all very different people.
I found it interesting because you are the only African-American character. It's like the weight of all of that rests on your character. And there are some people in this group who are not quite so comfortable with the connections, with the celebration together.
Yes.
And that to me felt very real because not everyone would be at that time.
Well, and Jessie, the character, is, I mean, she is very famous. She's very well known. And so she's allowed into a lot of, I think, circles that would not have been afforded to the average African-American of this day. Well, African-American, that was a term that wasn't even invented. There's all of these things that we are stumbling across in a historical manner. But yes, she is able to navigate and is indeed worshipped by the white population of the time because of her involvement with jazz and that popularity.
What was the term that was used then?
Negro.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Another word that was
colored.
Colored was the other. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And those were things that were considered acceptable.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And it really is helpful to really understand the place of these characters in the context of the, you know, the social climate of the time, and to remember that colored was a step forward from where we had been to be called that. And so there's a lot of things that I, Jessie's character, does not take issue with because no issue has been created in a present tense, if that makes sense.
Is that difficult as an actor? To kind of accept that that's where she is?
No, it's not difficult. In fact, it's refreshing. It removes a great deal of the burden of what my skin color was to me. Because again, this was a time of great explosion culturally, and I'm happy and I'm optimistic and I know where I've come from, which is fantastic.
Mm-hmm. It was such an amazing time, the end of the First World War, because the carnage of that war, it changed Europe.
Mm-hmm.
It utterly changed the art, the music, the writing, everything. And one of the characters that we haven't talked about, Dennis, is one of those writers that you know was changed mm-hmm. by all of that. And he's writing something that is probably Joycean, I imagine. That's, as I'm reading the script, I think of it as like nobody's seen anything like it before.
He's loosely based on F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Oh, is it Fitzgerald? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. And maybe his girlfriend, Rosamund, is Zelda. I think there's some argument to be made either way. It's a composite of a lot of characters. Certainly could be Joyce.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking in terms of the writing and the volumes.
Right,
right.
Well, there are lots of lines about how he's going to change the way writing is. And there's an argument for a lot of different authors. Time-wise, F. Scott Fitzgerald makes a little
more sense
yeah. there. And their lives and how their relationship, F. Scott and Zelda's relationship, is mirrored in many ways in this play.
Yeah.
Right. And it's so much fun to see how the playwright has pulled all of these threads together. If you know anything about this time period at all, you're kind of going, oh, is that who we're
right.
talking about?
Right,
or what's happening? And there's this wonderful kind of time travel component, too. And we can't talk about it too much, but there's a lot of sort of looking at what we might become, you know, and it comes out of that optimism, I think you're talking about, Marty, the idea that we could be anything.
Yes.
You know, and some of those things might or might not be so good.
Well, to me, this play is also about fate and choices. And is the future already in place and there's nothing we can do about it, or our choices, do they change what the future looks like for us? And what choices do we make that do change and have ramifications for the future?
And it also, I really think, addresses that if our fate is predetermined, then why look towards the end of things if they may or may not become tragic? Because what you're missing is the moment. Living in the moment and enjoying I love, there's a line in there that says essentially that we have to defer bleakness. And that's what gaiety is knowing that things may end in a bad way, but to live in the moment and enjoy what's happening right then. Because knowing your future may not be something you want to see.
I think most of us don't.
I do. I want to know. How many days do I have left?
I think you have to just assume you have none. And yeah. you go from there.
Yeah.
You know.
And again, encourages, then if this is the last day, you better have a good time.
Right.
Gidger. We haven't talked about Gidger.
Love Gidger.
What a great, who's playing?
David Flores.
Oh, I bet he's having fun.
He's great.
He's having fun and we are having fun
yes.
watching him.
Yes.
Yes.
Gidger is sort of the, well, he's not a servant. He's
an employee.
He's an employee right? of the publishing house. Mm-hmm. And sort of the person through which everything happens. In
yes.
some way.
Yes, agree. He's the one that questions all of these decisions. He's kind of the deus ex machina of the play mm-hmm. and being able to move things in directions that he doesn't even know he's doing. And he's funny, funny, funny.
Yeah.
And David is doing a really great job.
He's hilarious.
Of bringing that energy.
One of the things we've kind of talked around is that the language in the script and the overlapping dialogue and just the cleverness mm-hmm. of the writing, mm-hmm. of what you get to say. I'm envious.
Yeah.
Because it's delicious, delicious writing.
It's fantastic to speak. It has been, I think, a challenge for all of us as it relates to memorization in that the sentence structure is very heightened and sort of like we speak now, but with, you know, that poetic flavor on top of it. And it just, you know, again, speaks to the time and how language was used and how people enjoyed speaking. And Gidger, of course, that character has the bull by the horns as it concerns rhythm of speech.
Yes.
He's hilarious. So,
right, and literary references.
Literary
and
references.
And he's the smartest person in the room.
He's very
not really acknowledged to be, but,
which,
but
which
is.
He points out.
Yeah, yes,
he
many
tries
times.
To remind people, but they don't always listen.
And he shares with John Pace Severing, who's played by Neil Brookshire, the burden of knowledge. And I really think the gem of the play is understanding that you may know things, but it doesn't mean that you have to share them.
Which is always hard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because we don't want that burden.
No.
Well, it's going to be wonderful. I'm imagining the machine, the prop that we're talking about. I'm trying to imagine. I'm so looking forward to seeing how you do it.
You should be forward to the costumes. Woo!
Yeah,
they are beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah,
gorgeous costumes.
I bet.
Dresses made especially for Marty and Kara Johnston. And suffice it to say, there's a lot of paper on the stage.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. A lot of paper. We are getting 13 boxes of paper delivered today.
Is that enough?
Well, we'll see. Exactly. We shall see.
And welcome to the publishing house.
Welcome to the publishing house, indeed. Well, it's going to be a wonderful end of your season. And I can't thank you both enough for coming in. Best of luck in tech.
Thank you.
Break a leg. And I look forward to seeing it on stage.
Thanks so much.
Julie Swenson is one of the co-founders of Renaissance Theater Works. She's also director of the company's season finale, The Violet Hour, which opens at the Broadway Theater Center Thursday evening. Marty Goble stars as Jesse Brewster. There is more information at WUWN.com.
We will take one last break and then learn about a project coming to Milwaukee tonight that brings to light some long-lost Yiddish songs. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Yiddish is the language that brought us, among other words, the words schlep,
carry, or kvetch,
complain,
and nosh,
or eat.
It's only spoken in limited communities today, but for nearly 1,000 years, Yiddish was the primary language of Ashkenazi Jews all over Europe until the Holocaust.
Millions of Jews perished in the Holocaust, not just in Poland or Germany, but also in Soviet lands, including Central Asia and the Soviet Ukraine. Many other Jews became refugees, and it turns out some of these victims and survivors wrote songs about their experiences in Yiddish.
Anna Sternsis is a professor and historian at the Institute for Yiddish Studies at the University of Toronto. She had been researching Soviet Jews of the mid-20th century when she discovered a treasure trove of 150 formerly hidden Yiddish songs that were being held at the Kiev National Library. She teamed up with singer-songwriter Pavel Lyon, also known as Psoy Korolenko, to present a concert and lecture series. It's called Last Yiddish Heroes, Lost and Found Songs of Soviet Jews During World War II. They'll perform it tonight at UWM's Recital Hall.
Sternsis recently spoke with Lake Effect Mayan Silver and explained how she discovered the songs.
I started with my dissertation, which I wrote almost 15 years ago, on Soviet Jewish culture. I was interested in how Soviet Jews became who they became, the most secular, the most assimilated and integrated group of Soviet citizens. And I was interested in looking into what kind of Yiddish culture they created when they lived in a country ruled by Joseph Stalin. And my first book is about that, is about the Yiddish culture, which incorporated Soviet ideas and ideas of free society and justice and communism into itself. And when I was working on that project, I came across a large chunk of documents in the manuscript department of Kiev National Library, which had the collection of Yiddish songs and stories recorded during World War II. And that was a total shock to me because the historians and cultural historians knew that during World War II, Soviet Jews largely did not speak Yiddish. Instead, those of them who survived the war switched to Russian. But those songs documented how Soviet Jews made sense of World War II during World War II. And the material was simply astonishing in how original it was. And it did not look like anything that we knew that already existed from the Holocaust music, nothing like the music from Warsaw Ghetto, nothing like the music from Vilna Ghetto, either European ghettos. This was Soviet Yiddish music, which encouraged Jews to fight against Hitler, and which also documented how Jews were actually killed in the Soviet Union. Some of the first witnesses of killing came to us in form of songs. So this is how this project began.
What did you uncover when you found this trove of documents?
So most of this stuff was handwritten documents in Yiddish. They were recorded by a group of ethnomusicologists who work for the Kiev Institute for Jewish Proletarian Culture. One of them was Moisey Berigovsky, an important Jewish ethnomusicologist. So they wanted to collect all these documents and to compile them in a book on Jewish creativity during World War II, but they never finished this project because Berigovsky and his colleagues were arrested by Stalin in 1948 when the war was over. So what we have are the field documents, something that was written by hand. Sometimes the first drafts of the songs were typed, and this is the most important part, most of the songs did not have any tunes attached to them. Some of them had very, very basic tunes, but the majority of them did not have tunes because the work was not finished. They didn't finish putting all that together. And that's how our work with Psoy Korolenko began, because we needed to imagine what these tunes were like.
Yes. So Psoy, Anna calls you up and says, look, I found this, set of songs, probably about 150 songs from Soviet Jews during and after World War II. And what kind of background did you have that led her to call you, essentially?
I had been already fascinated by Yiddish language and by Yiddish popular culture, and specifically Soviet Yiddish culture. For example, I was part of the project which klezmerized famous Soviet popular songs, including some songs of World War II times and some later songs, which are classics and default education for any Soviet brought up person. They had been performed in Yiddish translation. So together with many klezmer musicians, we not only sang these songs in Yiddish, but also klezmerized them, so musically translated them. So I felt very open to conceptual work with Yiddish material, to reimagining it, rethinking it. And this idea of creating melodical solutions, reconstructing the tunes to which the simple, typical agent of Yiddish culture in Soviet Union, in Soviet Russia, in Soviet Ukraine would sing these songs during the war, it felt extremely inspiring and uplifting. And I started to work with this material with great enthusiasm.
First of all, for both of you, why was it so important to set these lyrics to music? I mean, why was that essential?
The major idea behind this project is to give voices to people who either were killed during World War II, of 6 million Jews who were killed during the Holocaust, 2.7 million were killed in the Soviet Union. And a lot of the songs were written by the victims, not survivors of the Holocaust. And, you know, there were 500,000 Jews in the Red Army. There were about 1.5 million Jews in Soviet Central Asia. And those are the people whose voices we never hear when we talk about the World War II or Holocaust. And what we wanted to do is that we wanted to create a project that will allow these materials to be what they were supposed to be music, as opposed to be a subject of academic research. At the same time, we also wanted to honor the scholars who spent years of their lives collecting these materials and who were never rewarded for this groundbreaking work, because all of them, as I mentioned, were arrested after the war was over. And Berigovsky and his family, for example, believed that all these materials, this whole archive, was lost forever. They thought Stalin destroyed it or the secret police destroyed it. And when it was found, it was an accident. So this material was too good to be kept in the ivory tower of academia. It had to be brought to the public as music, as art.
And Soy, where did you draw from to put the tunes together?
Actually, I was combining three approaches. Some songs clearly suggested a particular Yiddish or Soviet song to which apparently the song was sang. It was clear because of some particular lines in the songs which were direct quotations. In this case, suggesting a melody was like finding a family member, a close relative. In some other cases, we had to conditionally reconstruct the tune. So think about to what kind of tune it could be sung. And I found such melodies among popular Jewish and/or Soviet songs, sometimes combining two or more melodies, as typically an implied singer, popular singer, amateur singer would do intuitively. So this is what I call conditional reconstruction, or it can be compared with finding a distant relative. And in some rare cases, we suggested anachronistic solutions, taking melodies from contemporary songs, for example, from 1970s, or from very old songs, such as from 19th century, but they were really very much in the spirit of the lyrics. This is what I compare to a shidduch, to a matchmaking.
Yeah, nice. Well, it's kind of like sampling, you know, that people do in hip hop or remixing, like in electronic music. Except this is Yiddish, and you're doing it all based on the words and the lyrics and the poetry, right?
Right, and also based on our imagination of the cultural atmosphere of the time. A lot of the songs, and we know this from the notes, were sang to Soviet tunes, not to necessarily to Yiddish tunes, and also, a lot of the songs were sang to Cossack tunes. Cossacks, you know, known for, I don't know, its biggest enemies of Jews through history. But surprisingly to us, so many of these songs were sung to those Cossacks, Russian tunes. So we had to work with all that information, but also in a kind of an imaginative way, think about what will this, even if we didn't get the tune exactly right, exactly how they sang it, what would they think of the tune that Soy selected now had they listened to it? So it was important for us to think about would they have liked it or not? And very often when we were able to perform this material for the, say, Holocaust survivors or war veterans, people who were around during this time, they all really appreciated this project because they say, well, this is how our music sounded then, which was very, very rewarding to hear.
Anna, you've said that these songs, you said in a previous interview that these songs tell a story of Jewish resistance and survival in the Soviet Union. They represent, right, on so many levels, the foundation of contemporary Russian Jewish culture. You describe how they do that?
You know, we have a very large Russian-speaking Jewish diaspora today. About 500,000 Russian-speaking Jews live in the United States. Today, about 1 million in Israel. And they developed this Russian Jewish culture, which is distinctly different from, say, American Jewish culture, broadly defined, or even Israeli culture. And one of the important pillars of that culture is that they remember, they want to honor and celebrate the Jewish participation in the Red Army during World War II. Instead of seeing their grandparents or great-grandparents as just soldiers in the Red Army, they say, well, these are the people who saved Jews from the Holocaust, those who were saved. So that story is becoming a heritage story for that community. And because the majority of Russian Jews today live outside of Russia, we only have about 200,000 Jews left in Russia, that is also a story, one of the stories of American Jewish heritage, Canadian Jewish heritage, or wherever Russian-speaking Jews live. And that's why this project is providing the information, providing the foundation for this kind of identity and culture, and perhaps the future of the Russian-speaking Jewish community.
People listen to these songs. They may not come from a Russian background. They may not know any Holocaust survivors. They may not even be Jewish. What would you like those people to connect with in this music?
The songs have a very compelling history, the archive itself. We think about every single individual who wrote the song. They were going through perhaps the most difficult part of their life, and yet so much of the material has humor. And they're laughing at Hitler, they're laughing at the German army, they're laughing at themselves even a little. And this idea that in order to fight something, you have to laugh at it, that's the idea that does not require to have a Jewish or Yiddish or Soviet background. That's the idea that we all can relate to. That's one of the aspects of this project which we too find quite fascinating. The other thing is, so many of the songs are stories of love. Love between people who are separated by the war, love between husbands and wives, love of to their children, and children to their parents. The stories of violence that are heartbreaking and, of course, universally tragic. These are the stories that give us a chance to imagine people who lived in the middle of the 20th century as people, and hear their voices, and to, you know, relate to our past, to everybody's past, as something that turned us into who we are. And that part of the project is universal.
Well, and of course, you know, Yiddish is a very special language. Music is a universal language. And Soy Korolenko and Anna, thank you so much for speaking to us about the project, and thank you for doing the project.
Thank you so much for having us.
Anna Sternschitz is a professor and historian at the Institute for Yiddish Studies at the University of Toronto. She and Pavel Lyon, also known as Psoy Korolenko, will perform their show, Last Yiddish Heroes, Lost and Found Songs of Soviet Jews During World War II, tonight at 7 at UWM's Music Building. There's more information at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's edition of the show. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Thank you so much for tuning in today. And I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.